This morning we're continuing our series of studies in the book of Hebrews, in which Christ is presented as better than all. We have seen already that he has been presented as the superior messenger from God, the ultimate prophet. So he is our prophet, he is the greatest prophet, better than any of those who have gone before him. We've also seen that Christ is superior to the angels. The writer of this letter, writing at a time when certain people in the church were advocating the worship of angels. And the writer says, there is one who is to be worshipped, one only. He is superior to the angels who are but creatures. He is God and he is man, the man Christ Jesus. We've also seen that Christ is better than Moses. Moses, who was instrumental under God in forming the nation of Israel, in giving it its laws that would govern its civil life, its ceremonial life, and set the standard of its moral behavior. Moses, who instituted the Levitical priesthood as a means whereby people could come approach God in an acceptable way. Christ is better than Moses. And as we began to see last week, the writer now moves on from Moses to speak about the priesthood itself, that priesthood which Moses initiated, as it were. Christ is better than that priesthood. His priesthood is superior to that. Now there are similarities, there are parallels. After all, that priesthood was always intended to be a shadow, to be a type, to be an illustration of the true priesthood of Christ which was to come. It was always intended to be able to direct people to God in a manner that was acceptable to God. And so it's quite right then that we should see parallels between the Levitical priesthood, the Aaronic priesthood, the priesthood instituted by Moses, and the priesthood of the great high priest who was introduced to us last week, Jesus, the Son of God. But having introduced Christ as the great high priest, or the great, great priest, the superior priest, the writer now goes on to explain in a little more detail, to expand upon what he's already introduced briefly. And so in verses 1 to 10 of chapter 5, we see some parallels drawn out, but also a significant difference presented. Two significant differences, in fact. And as we proceed, I want, first of all, to look at the general description of the priesthood as it's presented, particularly in verses 1 to 4 of chapter 5. And then to look specifically at the perfect priest, Jesus Christ, as he's presented in verses 5 through 10. And in order to do so, I want first of all to look at the intended purpose of the priesthood. Why did the priesthood exist? What was its purpose? Well, the writer tells us in the very first verse, he says, every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. That was the purpose of the priesthood. I would hazard a guess that it's the purpose of the priesthood in any religion to present men, to act on behalf of men in relation to God. Even in false religions, that is the purpose, that is the aim of the priesthood. And here, in the priesthood appointed by God, this is what its purpose is. When Aaron was appointed to be priest, as we saw in our reading from Leviticus chapter 9 earlier in our service, he was appointed to stand in behalf of the people before God. What did he do in that reading that we had from Leviticus? He took offerings from the people and he presented them before God. He placed the sacrifice on the altar before God. He sprinkled the blood against the side of the altar. And then he went in to the tent of meeting and met there with God on behalf of the people. He acted on behalf of men in relation to God. Now, in order to do that, he has to be a man. He has to be able to relate to the men, to the people. So then, every high priest is chosen from among men and is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. He has to be one of them. In fact, more specifically, you see, when Aaron was appointed, he wasn't just appointed from among men, but he was appointed from among the tribe, among the nation. He had to come from them, from their stock, as it were, in order to properly and appropriately stand in their place, representing them before God. He had to be identified with them. And in order to fulfill this purpose, in order to act on behalf of men in relation to God, there's one very specific role that the priesthood had to fulfill. And that was to atone for their sins. To make it possible for the people to approach God. And so we're told, every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. Mankind is separated from God by his sin. And it doesn't matter how good a priest is. It doesn't matter how great a priest is. It doesn't matter how acceptable before God a priest is. He has to make the people acceptable to God. And the only way that that can be done is by removing their sins. And the only way that that can be done is if the sin is dealt with, is if the punishment is paid, the price of that sin is covered. Now, what is the price of sin? Well, it's death. The man who sins shall die. The wages of sin is death. Take it from the Old Testament, take it from the New Testament. The same message comes forth. The soul that sins, the man that sins, shall die. Death is the punishment for sin. And this then has to be removed. This then has to be taken away. How can it be taken away? Well, there is only one way, and that is with a substitute. With someone who doesn't deserve to die taking the place of that which does deserve to die. And bearing that punishment, taking death themselves. And that, of course, is what is symbolized in all the sacrifices of the Old Testament. We read of Aaron killing the bull, killing the goat, killing the lamb, taking the blood, spilling the blood at the foot of the altar or sprinkling it against the side of the altar. What do we see? What confronts us as we read those words? What picture is given to us in our minds as we read those words? It's a picture of death, isn't it? Of slaughter, of blood, of killing. Not a pretty picture. The ground where the temple, the tabernacle had stood when the Israelites moved on from that place must have been saturated by blood. Not a pretty sight. Because sin is not a pretty thing. And sin's consequence, greatest consequence, is death. The punishment of God against those who rebel against him. And so we're confronted then with this picture of death. The death of, here in this case, an animal or animals on behalf of the people, in the place of the people. But just as no priest can represent people unless he's identified with the people, no sacrifice can be a substitute for people unless it too is of the same kind. And so those sacrifices of the Old Testament only ever pointed forward to a real, a greater, a true sacrifice. As the writer of Hebrews will later go on to demonstrate, the blood of bulls and goats never took away sin. When Aaron there stood beside the altar and killed those animals and sprinkled their blood and put the carcass there and burned it up to atone for the sins of the people, the blood of those animals did not atone for the sins of the people. But it pointed forward to the sacrifice of one who would atone for the sins of the people. It was a picture, it was a symbol that pointed to something real. So the priest acted on behalf of men to represent them to God. He did so by offering gifts and sacrifices for sin. For without their sin being dealt with, the people cannot approach God. There is no place within the presence of God for those who are tainted by sin. But these priests had a problem. For they were sinners too. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. The priests represents the people before God. He does so by offering sacrifices for their sins. But this priest, because he is one of the people as a sinner, he must first offer sacrifices for his own sins. And so in Leviticus chapter 9, Moses first instructs Aaron to take a bull and to offer it as a sacrifice for his own sin. Only after he has done that can he then offer sacrifices on behalf of the people. His own sin must be removed. His own sin must be dealt with. He must be able to approach God before he can then bring the people to God. And so this sacrifice has to be made for himself, then for the people. And in fact, this would have been an annual observance. though Leviticus chapter 9 speaks of the first act of installing Aaron and his sons as priests and their first time representing the people to God, later on we have the account of the Day of Atonement, where a similar routine is followed. First the priest has to make atonement for his own sins, and then the priest atones for the sins of his people. Nevertheless, in all of this, we see a priest who understands, a priest who knows the weakness of the people that he's representing. And so he doesn't represent them in a harsh way, but he does so with gentleness. He speaks to them not critically, but he speaks to them as one who not only identifies with them as a person, but identifies with them as a sinner. And having atoned for his own sins by sacrifice, he then atones for their sins by further sacrifice. So here is the purpose of the priesthood: to represent people to God, to do so by dealing with the people's sins. The second thing that the writer tells us about the priesthood of the Old Testament is about its origin. The proper origin of the priesthood. No one takes this honour for himself, the writer says, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. Perhaps there would have been those who aspired to being priests, who longed for the prestige that that role offered, the place in society, the way the people would look up to you as a man of God. And certainly at the time when the writer of Hebrews was writing, this was a problem. The priests were appointed by Herod, by the governor. They weren't necessarily even from the tribe of Levi. But the proper priest had his origin by God's decree, not by man's decree. By God's choosing, not by his own choosing. There is no self-appointed priest. Moses was instructed by God to set Aaron and his sons apart as priests from within the tribe of Levi. And so that household was set apart. And so from generation to generation, the priests were always a descendant of Aaron. And I think that is what is meant when it says that no one takes the honour from himself, but only when called by God. Not that every individual priest was specifically called by God as Aaron was, but called by God in the sense that they follow in the rules, in the priorities that God had instructed Moses. The priest was to be of the tribe of Levi, of the house of Aaron. And what it emphasizes is that the priesthood is not a position of pride and ambition, but that the priesthood is a position of humility and service. The priest is to serve the people. The priest is to act on behalf of the people, not in his own self-interests. The priest is to use all his energy in representing the people to God, not in promoting his own position. The priest is one who is set in his place by another to serve in humility. Now this is significant, particularly as the writer fleshes out his argument with regard to Jesus Christ being the great high priest, being better than the Aaronic priesthood, the Levitical priesthood. So let us move on then to verses 5 to 10, to the second part where the focus of the writer's attention is upon Jesus Christ. And he begins with a direct reference to what he's just spoken about. No one takes this honour for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was, so also Christ. Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." As he says also in another place, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." And later at the end of that section, he was designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So here is the divine appointment of the perfect priest. He has not exalted himself to this position. Rather, he has humbled himself to this position. For remember, the priest had to be able to identify with the people that he represented. And it was no different for Christ. He too had to identify with the people that he would represent. And so, Jesus Christ, far from exalting himself by becoming a priest, actually humbles himself by becoming a priest. We are exhorted by the Apostle Paul to imitate Christ in his humility. "Have this mind among yourselves, which is also in Christ, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross." Far from exalting himself, Christ humbled himself in order to take up this position to which he had been appointed by his Father, the position of priest on behalf of people. He came down from glory, the Son of God, who had always existed in the splendor of heaven, in God's presence, came into this world spoiled, marred by sin, to represent sinners to God. The divine second person of the Trinity became a man to identify with the people whom he must represent to God. He's not exalted. He's humble, so that he may glorify his Father, and so that he may serve his people. And here we see the first of the big differences between these two priesthoods. This is a different order of priesthood. The similarity comes in that both are ordained by God. But Christ is not a priest after the order of Aaron. He is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now the writer of Hebrews is itching to talk about Melchizedek. But we're not going to talk about him this morning, for he has a lot more to say about him in the coming chapters. But enough to say that Melchizedek's position as a priest of God in the Old Testament is something mysterious
and unique.
But it set the tone, it set the place for the coming Messiah, who would be a priest, yes, but also a king. And you see, a priest after the order of Aaron, a Levitical priest, could never be a king in Israel. For the king and the priest came from entirely different tribes. The king was to come of the tribe of Judah. The priest had to come from the tribe of Levi. Nevertheless, both are able to identify with the people. Both come out of the nation. Both are Israelites. And so Jesus Christ, the Son of God, becomes a man, identifies with humankind in order to represent us to God. But he comes bearing a different priesthood that enables him to be both priest and king. And that's important for us as well. For we have a priest who has all authority over in heaven and upon earth, who rules over everything in bringing his people to God. So there we have the divine appointment of the perfect priest, which parallels the divine origin of the priesthood in the Old Testament system. We also have recognized the identity of the priest as being one from among the people whom he represents to God. Now remember, we started off by talking about the intended purpose of the priesthood. And so we will conclude by looking at the actual achievement of the perfect priest. Did he accomplish the purpose of priesthood? The purpose of priesthood is to act on behalf of men in relation to God. The purpose of priesthood is to bring sinful men into communion, into fellowship, into a right relationship with a holy God. We observe that the Old Testament priests only did so symbolically, as it were. None of their actions could actually save the people, but it pointed towards something that could save the people, and that is to the perfect priest. So let us consider the actual achievement of the purpose of priesthood by this perfect priest. In the days of his flesh, we're told, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. The first thing that we're confronted with here is the reality of Christ's suffering. Jesus Christ acted on behalf of his people. He offered prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears. But he also suffered. He learned obedience through suffering. Now let's consider these things a little. Firstly, what is it that the writer is referring to when he talks about Jesus offering up prayers and supplications? Is it just the general drift of Jesus' earthly ministry, his life here on earth, that this was the tone of his life, as it were? Well, certainly the prophet Isaiah foretold that this would be a Messiah who was acquainted with grief, a man of sorrows. But I think more specifically, the writer of Hebrews is referring to a particular incident in the life of Jesus Christ. And that was his agony in the Garden of Gethsemane. That night in which he had instituted the Lord's Supper, and after he had eaten it with his disciples, they went out of the city, and he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. The writer here says that he offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. How does that tie with the Garden of Gethsemane, if indeed that is what we're talking about? Well, some commentators suggest that Jesus was asking to be spared from death in the garden. That he was so overwrought by the circumstances that he was about to face that he could literally have died there. Possible that that's what's being referred to here. After all, in Luke's account, we are told that an angel was sent to strengthen him. And we know that his anguish was so great that a strange medical phenomenon was taking place where the blood vessels in his forehead were bursting and blood was mingling with his sweat. Such was the depths of his anguish at this time. So it is possible that this is the death that he is saved from. But I think to take that is to miss the point of the purpose of the priesthood in this context. What was the priest to do? The priest was to stand before God representing his people to God, making it possible for the people to approach God. That was the purpose of the priest, to bring sinful men and women into fellowship with a holy God. Now, Jesus' purpose, Jesus' mission into this world was to do that very thing, was to reconcile sinful people to a holy God. His whole reason for coming into this world was to bear the penalty for sin. Remember what I said earlier, that a sacrifice of substitution had to be made, but an animal sacrifice wasn't good enough. An animal could never take the place of a human being. Someone would need to stand in the place of sinners. Jesus Christ came into this world to do that very thing, to be a substitute, to stand in the place of sinners. His life was perfect. He was holy. He knew no sin, as we've already been told. Though he was tempted, he was without sin. He never gave in to the temptation. And so when he approaches the cross, he is perfect, he is untainted, he is the spotless Lamb of God. And he died on the cross. He died not because he deserved to die. He died because his people deserved to die and he was taking their place. That was his purpose, to reconcile sinful human beings to a holy God by offering his own perfect life as a substitutionary sacrifice for their sins. When Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, he knew what he was facing. He knew that what he faced was the anger of God, the wrath of his holy, beloved Father against sinners who have rebelled against him, turned their backs on him, and done all manner of unspeakable things. And Jesus knew that when he went to that cross, he would bear God's anger against sin. Against every sin of the people that God had chosen to give to him as his inheritance. He would bear God's anger against every falsehood spoken, every unkind word, every hurtful action, every immoral thought. Jesus Christ would bear the wrath of his Holy Father against adulterers, murderers, thieves and robbers, rebels of all kind, and every single one of those sins he would bear himself. The perfect Son, the one who had never sinned, the one whose right was to enjoy the pleasure and presence of his Father, unalloyed, unspoiled, for eternity. And at the end of his life, his earthly life, he faces the cross, having lived perfectly and earned righteousness for his people. He must yet die sacrificially and bear their sinfulness. And Jesus prays in the Garden of Gethsemane, "If it is possible, let this cup pass from me." What's he saying? Is it possible for me not to go through this? Well, of course it was possible for him not to go through it. He didn't have to die. He could have let all of us die instead. Is it possible for him to avoid death? Yes, it was. But it wasn't possible for him to avoid death and still save Peter. And that was the purpose of his priesthood, was to save people, to unite sinners to a holy God. That's why he came. And the writer of Hebrews tells us that he prayed, he supplicated before God with loud cries and tears. He prayed for those he would lay down his life to save. He prayed to the one who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. How do we know that Jesus Christ was heard? He died. He prayed to the one who was able to save him from death. He died. How can the writer possibly say he was heard? But you see, he achieved what he came to do. He was raised from the dead. He was saved from death. Death had no power over him. Oh yes, he had to battle with death. Yes, he had to wrestle death to the death. But he overcame death, you see. He destroyed death through his dying on the cross. And the grave couldn't hold him. The Prince of Life rose again from the dead, and as he did so, he set the captives free. Those who were in dominion under death, those who were bound and chained by their sins, were released. Because God saved him. God accepted his sacrifice. He accepted the holiness of his life on behalf of the people. And not only was Jesus Christ saved, in the sense of being raised again from the dead, but he achieved what he set out to do. And his people also are saved. You see, he learned obedience through suffering, and he was made perfect, not that he was ever imperfect. The point is that he succeeded where Adam failed. Adam was put to the test. Adam failed the test abysmally. Jesus was put to the test time and time and time and time and time again throughout his life, tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin. He overcame the test with flying colours. He was perfected. He learned obedience through suffering. Not that he was ever disobedient. But you see, the fact that he was tested, the fact that he suffered throughout his life, the fact that he was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, demonstrates that his obedience to God is real obedience. It's not just some plaything. It's not just some substitute for the real thing. Oh, Jesus has been through what we go through. And he succeeds where we fail. And he did it for us. He did it to save us from the consequences of our failure. And so he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. You see, Paul speaks about obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not that there's a whole list of rules that we have to keep. It's not that there are certain rituals that we have to perform. What is it to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ? To obey the gospel of Jesus Christ means to believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God. That he humbled himself and became a man. And that he died as a substitute for sinners on the cross. It's to believe in the person and work of Jesus Christ. And those who obey, those who believe him, are saved. He is the source of their salvation. And furthermore, their obedience to the gospel, their obedience to belief in Jesus Christ, will then result in the fruit of obedience to all his commands. And so the fruit of his obedience to God on their behalf, in their place, as their substitute, will be their obedience to him as their prophet, the best prophet, the greatest prophet, as their priest, the greatest priest, and as their king, their sovereign ruler. And so the writer writes to these Hebrew Christians and he says effectively to them, now why would you want to go back to the old way of doing things? Under types and shadows, under pictures and symbols, when you have the reality in Jesus Christ. Why go back to the old Levitical priesthood when you have this great high priest who has been perfected and has become the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him? Because you see, now that the perfect priest has come, there is no place for the symbols. Now that the great high priest has come, there is no place for the types and the shadows. Now that Jesus Christ has come, the Levitical, the Aaronic priesthood is done away with. There is nowhere else to go. There is no name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Hebrew Christians, the writer is saying, you can't go back. For to go back would be to disobey him. Would be to turn your backs on Jesus Christ, to whom all those other things pointed. There is no salvation in any other than him. Jesus Christ is the perfect priest.
Jesus Christ is the only Saviour. And those who would be saved from sin and have access to God must come through Him and must walk in obedience to Him. So if you're a Christian here this morning, and at times in the midst of difficulty, in the midst of suffering in your life, when the choice to follow Jesus Christ seems to bring overwhelming suffering to you, persevere. Don't give up. Hold on to this high priest, for he is the only one who can bring you to God. There is no other way. There is no other salvation.